It is Friday, January the 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us. Coming up, choosing the next U.S. president. Also ahead, the difficulties of getting all parties together to search for peace in Syria.
Setting the stage for negotiations to hold negotiations has proven a difficult and fragile process. The talks are to start against a backdrop of unceasing violence.
Plus, irregular migration in Africa and what superstar singer Rihanna is up to. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. We do begin this hour with U.S. politics and one of the last events before the voters begin to make their preferences known about who they'd like to see be the next U.S. president. There is an event. It is a debate between some of the leading Republican Party candidates. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone joining us now from Iowa. Many thanks, Jim, for being with us.
That's right, Steve. Happy to be here from the current center of the U.S. political universe.
Yeah, indeed it is. You know, let's talk about, before we get to the center of the universe, another center of the universe. I guess the debate's taking place in Iowa as well, isn't it?
Yes, a Republican debate, minus Donald Trump. That's the big news. Trump held an event of his own just a few minutes away from the auditorium where the debate was held. He, of course, was upset with the moderators on Fox, which is broadcasting the debate. And Trump was doing a benefit for wounded warriors, so he was focused on that. The rivals, interestingly enough, talked about Trump initially. Some made a little bit of fun that he wasn't there, but they pretty much have left him alone after that. I don't know in the end if this is going to hurt Trump or help him or what.
Yeah.
We just, you know, this election cycle has been so unpredictable.
Definitely that. In fact, I heard going into this some people were saying that CNN, which is a rival to the other cable station, Fox, which is carrying this thing, was going to carry the Trump event, and that they thought that a better judge of the way things might go is comparing the number of viewers to CNN as to the number of viewers of Fox, I guess, who knows?
That's right. Well, I'm sure if it turns out that more people watch the Trump event, you'll hear about that from Donald Trump. One little odd note, two of the lesser contenders, Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee, appeared with Trump at his event. That was a little interesting. By the way, those are the two men who were the last two winners of the Iowa caucuses in 2012 and 2008.
Let's talk about that, about the significance of Iowa being the first place where voters actually do something officially to decide who'll be the next president.
Yeah, it's evolved over time, Steve, since the mid-1970s, really. Jimmy Carter was one of the first people to make a real effort in Iowa. It helped him get on the map. That's what Iowa is important for. It gets you momentum. It gets your name up there. It gets you off to a big start. This is not a big state population-wise. It doesn't have a lot of delegates. But if you can build early momentum out of Iowa and then head into New Hampshire, which is the second state, you know, many people have done well on that basis. The one who really, you know, was made by Iowa in some ways was the current occupant of the White House, Barack Obama.
Indeed. I remember being in Iowa with you a long time ago, but it was when Howard Dean was on the cover of every magazine. Going into Iowa, they said, this man will be the nominee of the Democratic Party. We got out there and we found out that he'd got nowhere near it. It ended up that that two others, John Kerry and his running mate, eventually took the state in that case. So I guess we don't know until it's all said and done. Before we leave you, Jim, just want to find out what happens after Iowa. There are more people to make decisions in the country.
Oh, that's for sure. And we go then to the first primary state, New Hampshire. A different electorate, not quite as conservative, not quite as many, say, Christian activists who are active in New Hampshire. That's where the moderate candidates may come to the fore, people like Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Chris Christie. So that the test in Iowa is really among two conservatives, Ted Cruz and Donald Trump. When we get to New Hampshire, those more moderate establishment candidates will have their moment to make a play.
And I guess we should say the Democrats are running candidates in these things as well, right?
You know, they sure are, and it's going to be a tight race, and it's really something to watch, the Bernie Sanders-Hillary Clinton race. It's really something here, Steve, with two competitive races at once.
Indeed. Many thanks to you, Jim. Jim Malone, our national correspondent, joining us from Iowa. Up next on International Edition, African-American communities seeking the power of the U.S. ballot.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
And while African Americans tend to vote for Democratic Party presidential candidates, their level of turnout in 2016 in this upcoming election could be an important factor in determining who is elected the next president of the United States, especially in a tight race. And as Jim just mentioned, there's a tight race for sure. While energizing African American voters to turn out may be causing some concern for the Democratic Party, leaders in communities of color say there is a good news because they want to hold candidates of both parties, both the Republicans and Democrats, accountable to ensure that their voices are heard. VOA's Ramon Taylor gives us a look into all of this from New York.
The case is captured on video of deadly police force against unarmed African Americans over the past 2 years have galvanized a tech-savvy generation of activists to inject new life in an age-old push for racial, economic, and social equality. Carl Lipscomb of an organization that advocates on behalf of African American and black immigrant communities says candidates should do more than just make promises if they expect community members to come out in droves on election day.
It's not enough to say, you know, we want free education for everyone. We want to know how this is going to impact black people. We want elected officials to talk about how they're going to address the black jobs crisis.
The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics says the unemployment rate among blacks in the United States, 9.4%, is nearly double the overall rate nationwide. It's a problem that extends to African immigrants. Bakri Tanja, a policy advocate at African Services Committee, says progress is necessary across all levels of government, including the city of New York, under Mayor Bill de Blasio.
He is a progressive mayor. But in his administration, I have not seen any African immigrant appointed or in a meaningful position. And the same thing goes at the state level, at the federal level.
Grassroots coordinators say the Black Lives Matter movement and the anti-immigration rhetoric by some presidential candidates have produced a new generation of civil rights leaders.
It doesn't look the way that it used to look. It's not big organizations, but they can mobilize people. They have a clear voice, and they are winning changes across the country.
Ahead of the 2016 presidential primaries, there is good news for Democratic Party frontrunner Hillary Clinton. A recent Gallup poll shows Clinton currently has an 80% favorability rating among adult blacks, the highest positive net favorable rating of all candidates. Now the question is whether they will turn out to vote on Election Day. Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
And you can stay up to date on what's happening in the U.S. presidential race at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. After being delayed, talks are set to get underway in Geneva Friday on what promises to be a long road to peace in Syria, where the conflict, soon entering its fifth year, has killed 250,000 people. VOA's Luis Ramirez has a preview of those talks.
Syrian government representatives decided to attend the talks after discussions earlier this month with a UN special envoy in Damascus. For the UN envoy, it's an important first step.
My job is to be always optimist.
But even setting the stage for negotiations to hold negotiations has proven a difficult and fragile process. The talks are to start against a backdrop of unceasing violence. Two bombs killed 19 people in the Syrian government stronghold of Homs Tuesday. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility. As UN-designated terrorists, Islamic State militants are not invited. Organizers are doing everything possible to avoid spoiling the talks before they start and leaving potential troublemakers off the list. After Turkey threatened to withdraw support of the talks, word came from France's foreign minister that the Russian-backed Syrian Kurdish party was out.
The PYD, the Kurdish group which was causing the most problems, Mr. Dermistura told me he had not sent them an invitation letter.
Once in Geneva, the plan is to keep all parties in separate rooms with no face-to-face meetings. The important thing, say analysts, is that something is being done.
This is a realistic appraisal of international consensus that we need to have some sort of political process going on, perhaps a recognition of the parties, certainly the opposition parties, that they're starting to get exhausted with the conflict itself, and it has been so damaging on every level, humanitarian and otherwise. So that there's some sort of a process going on.
The opposition is setting goals. They want, at a minimum, a broad-based ceasefire, an end to the siege, and access for humanitarian aid to all parts of Syria. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, London.
International Organization for Migration has found that in 2015, five countries in the Horn of Africa, they are Djibouti, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia, and Sudan, experienced a marked increase in what's called irregular migration by land and sea from a year earlier. Craig Murphy is the IOM spokesperson in Nairobi, Kenya. VOA's Kim Lewis speaks with him about irregular migrant flows and why the increase of migrants going to Yemen continues at a surprising rate.
In 2015, we have for the first time significant numbers of displaced persons arriving in the Horn of Africa to the countries referenced from Yemen. The onset of the war in Yemen in April of 2015, which goes to the present and doesn't seem to have an end in sight, has generated a significant amount of displacement. Approximately 75,000 individuals arrived in the Horn of Africa, and most of them were split over the two countries of Somalia and Djibouti, as compared to the previous year where there was not a conflict or it wasn't a large-scale conflict in Yemen as we've seen in 2015. And we had almost no arrivals in the Horn of Africa. Almost all of the migration was from the Horn of Africa crossing the Gulf of Aden and arriving in Yemen. And if you look at the other location, the policies within European countries, the response in the Mediterranean, various factors in countries of origin in the Horn of Africa have combined to make a situation where Europe has been seen by many as an attractive option. Not easy to get there in the manner with which they are traveling, but it has still been received a large number of migrants and refugees from the Horn of Africa through two main entry points into Europe, Italy and through Greece, and then sometimes staying in those countries, but often moving further into Europe to other countries.
Looking at Yemen, your report points out that this increase is surprising. So can you explain why that is surprising that migrants are going into Yemen?
Well, typically people think of conflict and situations of armed conflict and aerial bombardment, which is happening on a large scale and has been for around 9 or 10 months in Yemen, would be a deterrent and contributes to people leaving a country in terms of an exodus or refugee populations that are fleeing for their lives and seeking asylum in other countries, which has happened from Yemen. But the flip side of that is that most people are less familiar with the population dynamic that conflict and the breakdown of the rule of law also contributes and can serve as a magnet or an attraction for those seeking to pass through a country. And it's despite the insecurity and the risk of the armed conflict, they are able to pass borders to enter countries in an easier manner than if it was a peacetime.
And looking at the number of deaths of those migrants crossing the Gulf of Aden in 2015, you all have noted there was a decrease. What is that attributed to?
In the Horn of Africa, that's correct. And the mechanisms and the monitors and the recording systems that we have in place have recorded 246 individuals lost their lives at sea in 2014. That number dropped significantly in 2015 to 95 individuals in the year of 2015, in the 12-month period from January to December. There's not an easy answer or a clear explanation as to why that went down. There's a multitude of factors that go into these, but we simply use the number of migrants' lives that are lost at sea as an important indicator for analyzing the situation. Some speculate, and I tend to agree with it, that there was such an increase in movement in both directions across the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea between Djibouti, Somalia, and Yemen, those going to Yemen to try to capitalize on the lawlessness in terms of entering the country, but also those making the decision to flee, being displaced, and to leave Yemen. There was a lot of maritime movement by boats across these bodies of water. So typically there are quite small boats, fishing boats that are used to smuggle migrants. But in 2015, since there was more of a demand for this maritime movement, the speculation and the consensus seems to be that a lot more boats, and many of them literature larger and more seaworthy, so less prone to capsizing, probably led to about 60% reduction in deaths from 246 in 2014 to 95 in 2015.
Also, it's been noted that 36 migrant lives were lost at sea in the first week of this year, 2016, in the Gulf of Aden. Looking ahead for 2016, what do you anticipate in terms of migrant deaths?
It's hard to predict, but if you extrapolate the statistics, I think it's going to be largely a continuation of what we have seen. We hope that the dynamics are such that irregular migration and the challenges and the loss of life associated with it will not increase and will maintain the status quo or decrease this year. There doesn't seem to be a quick or easy resolution to the situation in Yemen. We are definitely predicting to see continued movement to and from Yemen between the Horn of Africa countries in 2016.
That's Craig Murphy. He is a spokesperson for the International Organization for Migration. He's in Nairobi, Kenya, and he was speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis, host of the program Africa News Tonight. It is time now to look at social media and what they're saying about the global spread of the Zika virus. That's a mosquito-borne disease that appears to be causing severe birth defects. Michael Lippin is here with details. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Steve. You know, the World Health Organization's latest warnings about the Zika virus are resonating widely across social media, with many news organizations tweeting stories about those warnings with the hashtags Zika and Zika virus. Many of those stories have alarming headlines, like this one from U.S. magazine Newsweek. The Zika virus could infect up to 4 million people, WHO says. And this one from U.S. network NBC's Today Show, which is at Today Show on Twitter. There's no treatment and no vaccine for the Zika virus. Well, the U.N. agency itself has been tweeting frequently on the situation, as you can imagine. Earlier Thursday, two WHO medical specialists gave an update to the media, and the WHO Twitter account posted a series of quotes from them. Here's one quote from Dr. Silvan Aldeguieri. Zika spreads rapidly in the Americas because the population does not have immunity and the Aedes mosquitoes are everywhere. And here's another quote from Dr. Bruce Aylward. In the face of so much uncertainty on the Zika virus, it's important to demonstrate caution, particularly around pregnant women.
And Michael, what have U.S. authorities been saying about this Zika virus on social media?
Well, President Obama's National Security Council tweeted about Zika a few hours ago. Its handle is at NSC44, and it posted a link to a White House website blog by Deputy Assistant to the President for Homeland Security, Amy Pope. In the blog, Pope tries to answer a series of frequently asked questions about Zika, including, should we be concerned about Zika in the United States? Pope writes that the U.S. mainland does have Aedes species mosquitoes that can become infected with and spread the Zika virus. She says U.S. travelers who visit a country where Zika is found could also become infected if bitten by a mosquito. So it's obviously a topic that's getting more and more attention within the United States at the highest levels of government. Steve?
Andy, many thanks to you, Michael. That's International Edition's Michael Lippin. You know you can find Michael on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and you can follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? Well, they're calling it the first foldable headset for movie lovers. Who's they? The Royal X Company, makers of the soon-to-be-released Royal X headset. It features a video monitor that flips out from the top and folds down to completely cover the eyes. Royal X Video boasts a contrast ratio of 10,000 to 1 and a pixel density of 3,300 pixels per square inch. The headphones provide noise cancellation up to 22 decibels. Everything you see on the headset can be adjusted, including focus and optical strength on each eye and even how far apart the eye slots are. The headset supports Wi-Fi sharing, wireless streaming, USB, and HDMI. There are a couple of downsides. The headset is pretty bulky, and you do have to carry around an external controller for the battery and the connections. Also, it's pretty expensive at $699. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossman.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us today. You know that rhythm and blues and hip-hop star Rihanna has released her long-awaited new album. I think it's called Anti. Well, anyway, it's out there. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about this new album, why it took so long to get it out there, and why fans could look forward to what they're getting from Rihanna.
Rihanna's long-awaited album, Anti, is finally out. VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee is here. Shauna, first of all, let's start off. Why'd this take so long to get this album done?
I wish I could answer that question for you. I don't know. We never got a clear answer from Rihanna or anyone in her camp. The only thing that I can assume based on what I've been reading over the last year is that Rihanna wanted to take her time to create what she was calling a classic album, one that would withstand the test of time. And so I think anytime you go into the studio or you begin a creative project with that in mind, you have to take a little more time than normal. I think she knows very well how to bang out what they call a radio hit, something that she can release. It'll go straight to the charts. Everybody will love it for about 6 or 7 months, and then she'll release another one that will replace that. This album is nothing like what we have heard from her in the past. And so I imagine that is a big part of it. Also, she has done something very interesting in terms of releasing this album. I know we talked a while ago about this deal that she signed with Samsung, and there were no real details at that time, but we know now that she worked with Samsung to create this website called Anti-Diary. And so they have all of these virtual rooms that over the last few months you had to go through to get codes, and then the last room would give you a code in which you could use to download the entire album for free. So I imagine that that may have also been why it took a little longer than anticipated to release the album.
Going to make you work for it to get to all the cuts. Have you heard any of the cuts on this album?
I've not heard the whole thing because I don't have the code, but I've been able to listen to, I think I heard about 7 or 8 cuts. Interesting, she released 3 songs last year. She released American Oxygen, 4 or 5 Seconds. That was the one with Paul McCartney and Kanye West. Be Better Have My Money. We all assumed those songs would be on the album. They are not. So these are all new songs. I heard the first single, which is Work with Drake. That was released on Wednesday. I've heard a couple of other ones. A lot of ballads, kind of slow and mid-tempo cuts on this album versus what we're used to. She's
No EDM, electronic dance music.
Right. She's well known for EDM. She's well known for her reggae-influenced cuts or her hip-hop-inspired cuts. They're there, but not to the degree that we've known and heard in the past.
Now, can people look to hear Rihanna on the Soul Lounge?
Well, we will be playing that one cut work this week, absolutely. And as the albums are released, you know, we have to play by the rules here. So as the label releases the songs, of course, I'll be playing each and every one of them that I get my hands on.
All right. Well, if you would like to send a tweet to Shauna, she is at VOA Lady DJ. You can also find her at the Soul Lounge. That's on our website, voanews.com. And you can also hit us up. We are at VOA underscore IE.
Very good. Thank you, guys. That's interesting. You know, since we can't hear anything from Auntie right now, you have to wait and get it on Soul Lounge later on. I thought we ought to go back a ways. Remember 2005? Rihanna just hit the United States scene, and she had this song. We'll get to it in a second. I have to tell you, just a little interjection here. I happen to be out at Reston Town Center, which isn't far from here, having a bite of lunch with some friends and my wife. And who was performing 20 feet from me, but Rihanna and her posse right there. It was amazing. I couldn't believe it. Never had heard of her, but it didn't take long to hear Pwn the Replay. It was her first big hit here in the United States. Pwn the Replay must be some Barbadian phrase, you think? Pwn the Replay? It must be. Great song, though, and you're going to hear some more of it. Thanks for joining us today on the Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, John Ellison, smart man about music himself, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Hope you have a great Friday. Now some more of Rihanna.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States is determined to disrupt the illicit flow of money from the trade of oil and trafficking of antiquities to the terrorist group Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. Toward this end, the U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to the significant disruption of the sale and or trade of oil and antiquities by, for, on behalf of, or to benefit ISIL. Through its illegal oil operations and trafficking in looted archaeological material from Syria and Iraq, ISIL has generated millions of dollars in hard currency, enabling it to brutalize and oppress innocent civilians. This is the first time the U.S. Secretary of State has authorized a Rewards for Justice offer for information that could be used to disrupt the sale or trade in oil and antiquities by or on behalf of a terrorist organization. Anyone with information on oil and antiquities trafficking that benefits ISIL can contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net or by standard mail at Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303. USA. Individuals in North America can also call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927. All information will be kept strictly confidential. The Rewards for Justice program is administered by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Diplomatic Security. Since its inception in 1984, the program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that put terrorists behind bars or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. Follow us on Twitter at https://twitter.com/rewardsforjustice, as in the numeral 4.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.